downloading the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents. June is First Books Month on the Missouri Review Sound Booth. This month, we'll bring you four writers whose first full-length books have recently been published. On this week's episode, Kate Sweeney reads from and talks about her new nonfiction book, American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning, published by the University of Georgia Press this past March. American Afterlife explores the experiences of individual Americans involved with death in a culture where even discussing such things is practically taboo. Sweeney's book follows ordinary people making memorial choices, as well as the purveyors of those choices, to investigate how we memorialize our dead, where these practices came from, and what this says about us. Kate Sweeney's radio stories appear regularly on Atlanta's NPR station, WABE 90.1 FM. Her writing has appeared several times in Oxford American Magazine, as well as Udney Reader Online, Atlanta Magazine, and New South, among other outlets. Listen in as Kate reads excerpts from American Afterlife and then discusses the book afterwards.
I'll start with this moment from the book's very first chapter called American Ways of Death. John Austin had been working as founding curator at the Museum of Funeral Customs for about a year when he had a curious visitor. His office door is always open to the lobby, so he could observe her as she neared the exit. "Thanks for visiting," he called. She was an elderly woman, probably in her late 70s or early 80s, and she nodded in his direction as she passed the antique carriage hearse on her way out. But then she stopped and stood completely still for a moment before turning around and returning to his office doorway. "You didn't tell all of the story," she said. When recounting this, John Austin recreates his own confused expression. He asked her, "What exactly have we failed to include?" She paused and then said, "You haven't explained what they do with the rest of the body." And John Austin thought, "Rest?" But what he said was, "I'm sorry, but I can't understand. Can you give me more information?" After one more confused exchange, she told him what she meant. When she was a child, a grown-up had told her that what you see in the casket is all that's present. That's why they only open the upper end of the casket, because that's all that's there. And now this octogenarian asked him, "What do they do with the rest of the body?" John Austin's chief joy in life sprang from putting together picture-perfect exhibits like those here, the 1930s embalming room display with its gleaming metal table, the early 20th century home funeral display with its chrome-plated Art Deco casket jacks. These opportunities to delve into and recreate history had driven him to pursue this career. He had not anticipated ever being faced with counseling a stranger about her personal experiences with funerals and death. This is a section from the chapter about Juana Hogrief, a memorial photographer. It's called, the name of the chapter is Memory Maker. Juana Hogrief had just returned to her day job after 48 exhausting hours coaching a woman through childbirth. It was Juana's first experience working as a doula, an intensive non-medical birthing assistant. While training, she had learned about a group of volunteer photographers who take infant remembrance photos for parents in the opposite situation, those sad cases when newborns have died or have been given terminal diagnoses. The invitation stirred something in her. Without hesitation, she put her name on the interest sheet. Weeks passed, then months. And it was this day, after her first experience helping a mother bring a child into the world, that she got her first call from a hospital about a death. A new mother wanted a set of remembrance photographs of her dying newborn. Juana is no timid soul. She had photographed the dead before, had always felt drawn, in fact, to documenting birth and death. Still, this call was jarring, coming now when her eyelids felt like sandpaper every time she closed them. And when she did, fervent images from the last 48 hours came flooding back. She had also just missed 2 days at her regular job as a software developer. Her lunch break, which she had planned on working through, was just about to start. By any common sense judgment, she could take a pass this once. Instead, she found herself thinking of Providence, and she found herself saying yes to the nurse on the phone. At the hospital, she walked into a room where a girl, young enough to be her own daughter, sat on a bed under fluorescent lights, crying beside a newborn who had died already. The teenage mother's real mother was absent. "I hugged her," says Juana, "and I told her I was proud of her." Juana is in her late 30s, although there's a pixie-like agelessness about her face. At a rare trip to a bar recently, she was carded by a concerned bartender who took her for a 20-year-old. That day at the hospital, she says, "All I knew is I couldn't rush this girl." She took a full 2 hours there, snapping photographs, to give the girl something she couldn't create on her own after this loss, a specific kind of memory, one that was beautiful. So the funeral home got its start as a business around the turn of the 20th century, and I write a lot about that in the book. At that time, splashy trade publications had names like The Casket and Sunnyside. The pages were rife with brand new inventions. One issue contains an ad for a patented metal chin supporter to keep a dead jaw from dropping open in the middle of a viewing, and a number of competing burglar-proof vaults. And then there's the patent notice from an Ohio man in the July 1880 issue of The Casket for the coffin torpedo, which would fire a missile at any would-be grave robbers. As a safeguard, the torpedo included a rod that extended to the surface of the ground to prevent any accident when filling the grave. How exactly this safety rod would prevent the torpedo from wounding innocent gravediggers is not explained. One story that this book turned out to be largely about was how death left the home and became strange to us. The term funeral home was still tentative in the early 1900s. The funeral chapel came first, and then for a while, businesses were called funeral parlors, a name coming from the room in the family homes where people had traditionally met with company and laid out their dead. But then, around World War I, parlors began disappearing from homes. Homemaking magazines decried gloomy parlors, now linked inescapably in people's minds with death before the advent of modern medicine, favoring instead a new kind of space and title, the living room. Funeral operators themselves followed suit to avoid appearing Victorian and outdated. Their businesses became funeral homes. In later decades, when many funeral operators abandoned the old mansions for standalone businesses, they abandoned the term home, too, in favor of the ever more distant professional funeral service. Yet most of us still think of them as funeral homes, those places where death lives. And the final excerpt that I'll read is from a chapter called With the Fishes. I went on a number of adventures writing this book, and one of them was with a group of families who went out on a boat off the coast of Charleston, South Carolina. They'd had their loved ones' ashes made into artificial coral reefs that actually functioned. Like, they jettisoned those to the bottom of the sea, and the reefs grew actual coral on them. And this was with a company called Eternal Reefs. So I'm just going to read a short excerpt from that chapter. Leslie Cullen and her mother, Penny, watch our boat's wake. Leslie's husband, Bill, died last August from a brain tumor. He was 58. He was also, as summarized by Leslie, a building inspector, a skier, a scuba diver, and a master woodworker. But what Bill Cullen was most proud of was his job in the water rescue squad on New Jersey's Passaic River. He was also a Vietnam vet and a firefighter, a busy man. "Oh yeah, he did everything," says Leslie, rapidly chewing her gum. She talks fast. An energetic blonde in her early 50s, she's attractive in the sinewy, bronzed way of women who spend a lot of active time in the outdoors. As she talks, I envision a closet at her home devoted to wetsuits and skis and those hiking backpacks with frames. After Bill was diagnosed, Leslie says his fellow firefighters threw a big party in his honor. With lots of beer, she says. He was a Budweiser lover and loved to party. When he died, Leslie says, they had the big deal fireman's funeral with bagpipes and everything. "And that was what Bill wanted," she says, talking rapidly. "But this is what he really, really wanted, I think. final rest in the Atlantic Ocean, in addition to four other places. Leslie has also scattered or buried Bill's ashes on his favorite Vermont ski run, underneath the apple tree in their backyard, in the Passaic River, and below the window of his building inspection office, because he liked to be everywhere, she says. She wanted to scatter in Jamaica, too, but I was afraid the airport sniffer dogs might stop me, she says. Right this moment, dead Americans across the continent are getting made into diamonds and ink drawings. A business in Illinois will make you into actual plant fertilizer so that Aunt Maggie really can feed her favorite rose bush for years to come. Another company called Celestis will shoot your ashes out into a victory lap around the planet for less than it costs to fly to London. Today, we are opening the space frontier for all of us, announces the website of their partner company, Space Services Incorporated. In 10 years of business, the company has flown the cremains of hundreds of people, including James Doohan, that's Scotty of Star Trek fame, and one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, L. Gordon Cooper. After-death experiences marketed toward lifelong passions are way up in and they're multiplying. And while most new memorialization options seem to involve ashes, some do not. Now I need to explain here really quickly that there were families of seven deceased represented on this boat, and six of the deceased were human beings, and one was a cat named Mistopheles, and his parents had come all the way to Charleston from California to oversee his ashes into the Atlantic as an artificial coral reef. If the families of Mistopheles had decided they wanted to hold on to a lifelike version of their cat, there's an array of companies willing to compete for their business. My favorite is Perpetual Pet, a freeze-drying service. Unlike taxidermy, pet owners who opt for freeze-drying reclaim their entire pet rather than just its outsides molded over an artificial form. This allows pet owners to see, touch, and hold their pets, reads their web copy, and in a sense, never have to let go. It's true. Perpetual Pet's site is full of photographs from satisfied customers of their Persians, Pomeranians, and even one lop-eared rabbit, all seated in lifelike poses. I just can't stop thinking of the extra dimension this would add to one's life, the explanation to new visitors, the dusting. Thank you.
Thanks, Kate. That gives us a great sample. My first question for you is, why mourning? What about kind of death in the mourning process fascinated you so much that you actually pursued a whole project about it?
Sure. Well, I like to joke with people that just one day I was hanging out in the cemetery as I do every weekend. I'm not a goth person. as a teenager, I didn't hang out in cemeteries smoking clove cigarettes and listening to Bauhaus or The Smiths. I did listen to The Smiths, but that's unrelated. That was just normal, like, teenage angst. I think a big part of that ended up being that the worlds of mourning and funeral present and past are just so full of really fascinating little known facts. And so, I mean, it started out, I was obsessed with the show 6 Feet Under, that TV show that was on HBO about the funeral directing family. And I ended up reading an article in The New Yorker by Tad Friend in which he mentioned, it was just like in this one footnoted paragraph, that the nation's first green burial cemetery was located in South Carolina. And that was really close to where I lived at the time. And so I thought, this looks interesting, sort of this eco-friendly style of burial, green burial. No one's done a profile of these folks. So I went and I did that story just because I was interested in learning about something I didn't know about. And it just kind of snowballed from there. Sort of like this world of information opened up to me via the internet and friends. And seemingly everywhere I looked, I saw, you know, oh, wow, you know, something about the history of embalming fluid over here. Or like, you know, over here, there's this, you know, company in Georgia that will take your ashes and make them into artificial coral reefs. So the more I sort of studied and learned and talked to people, the better I became at dinner parties. So that's like sort of one part of it. It was so much fun to be able to tell people about the history of embalming fluid or about like the surprising history of the funeral vault, which is something I knew nothing about before. But then another part of it kind of wound up being, you know, I came to the point where I'd amassed a lot of pages. And I sort of needed to ask myself why I was writing the book, you know, like the so what? Like, you're writing all this, but why? And the book is not about me. I'd like to underscore that. But I think that I was writing it in a way because I had not experienced yet catastrophic loss. And I was in my late 20s and my early 30s writing this. And like many of us who are writers and artists, you know, you kind of explore the things you're curious about through your craft, right? So I was curious and terrified of death and losing people that I loved especially. I mean, just really freaked out by it. And so, and still am, by the way. And I think this was just sort of a way of exploring that fear, sort of seeing what I could expect when it happened to me.
Yeah, I think what's also interesting about your book is that it could be a real downer, you know, it could be just really depressing, but it's not. And many parts of it are really, really funny. Obviously, it had to be some kind of, you know, intentional move on your part to strike the right tone. So I wonder how you figured out, you know, what tone of the book would have when so much of the material is inherently sad. And yet there seem to be these like really lively, quirky moments that go along with that.
Right. And I worked, that's a great question. It's something that I worked very hard at, to be respectful of, because people were telling me their stories of great loss and were going through mourning, like right in front of me a lot of the time. And it was so important that I be respectful of them and that I honor the fact that they were sharing their stories with me. But at the same time, I naturally find a lot of things to be funny. Like, I just naturally do. And so what I worked to get at was sort of that sense of, you know, when you're sitting at a memorial service or a funeral and something funny happens and you're not supposed to laugh, but then a whole group of you ends up like trying not to laugh and trying not to laugh, but then you do anyway. And so that's sort of what I've decided, why I've decided the humor in this book is okay. But what I worked hard at was trying to discern, you know, I went through many, many, many drafts and trying to discern what was actually funny and actually natural humor and what was artificial humor introduced by me because I wasn't comfortable with the subject matter, right? Because here we are, it's the 21st century. And what I discovered working on this book is that I think we are at kind of a remove from death and dying. And I'm not saying we, I don't mean all of us, 100% of us, but many of us, and sort of culturally, I think we're not comfortable with it. And I'm not comfortable with it. And so I had to go through and figure out what was me feeling uncomfortable and just saying, haha, we're going to make fun of something here in a moment that isn't actually funny, but is just uncomfortable. And so I went through it again and again and again, trying to sort of figure that out. And I feel good with where it stands now. You know, I am a huge fan of, probably this won't be shocking, but like, you know, I'm a big fan of Sarah Vowell. And she writes a lot of books about sort of going on these adventures through, and in her case, it's often like historical. I admire her writing style. And I think this book started out a lot more Sarah Vowell influenced than it ended up. Because I love her writing, but at the same time that, you know, you kind of learn as you continue to write and you continue to write and continue to write that you can be influenced by your favorite writers, but you can't be them. You know, I think George Saunders said something great about that, about, you know, he wanted to climb Mount Hemingway, but then he got there and he found a set of footprints that didn't fit him or something like that because somebody had already climbed it and it was Hemingway. And so he ends up climbing like, you know, he's very self-deprecating. So he says something about like a pile of crap or something. And it's like Saunders, which, you know, we all know isn't true because he's George Saunders. But at any rate, I feel pretty good about the balance I've struck and that sort of all the way through, it is genuinely my genuine reaction to what's happening. And people that have, and I've gotten pretty good reaction from readers, people who, actually a lot of the subjects in the book have said that they appreciate the mix, like that there is humor in there, because in any dark moment, there is sort of this like perverse sense of lightness that can come through, can kind of peek through. And sometimes that makes dark things look even darker, right? And vice versa. So I hope I've done a good job at that, but that was a big challenge for sure.
And I should say you are a reporter for an NPR station in Atlanta. So how is the story, or the story that you developed when writing this book, how is that kind of storytelling different than your kind of day job, you know, NPR storytelling or reporting?
Well, a lot of the techniques were the same. When I went out with the group of families on the boat, or when I went to the conference in New Mexico of obituary writers, or and just when I went out reporting things, I recorded everything with a digital recorder, which is what I do for radio. I have not learned to take a good shorthand, which is, I know, to my detriment. I need to learn to do that, but I like to know that I get everything right. It's very important to me that I quote people correctly and that I get the tone and I get the moment right. And so it's just way more comfortable for me to just record things. And there are, you know, drawbacks and there are advantages, of course. I would say that the main difference that I can think of there, though, in terms of how the whole thing turned out, is that in this book, I was much more present as a narrator than I am in any of my radio stories for the station. Because, you know, think about like the 4 to 6 minute radio stories you hear. You hardly ever hear the presence of, like, you don't hear the journalist, the reporter in there very much. And so it was, I worked on this, it was originally my MFA thesis at University of North Carolina, Wilmington, after working in a newsroom for like 3 years. And it was so refreshing to put myself in something. I was just like, yay. And then I wasn't sure what the balance should be on that. And so there was like so much conversation and workshop about like, we want more Kate, or me feeling like I'd put too much Kate in and not being sure what that balance should be. But so I'm in there and I take a lot of elements of journalism. Everybody's stories in there, I have researched the heck out of, I've fact-checked it to death. Everything in there is absolutely accurate to my knowledge, but my opinions are also there. And that's what makes it, you know, there's that the term that in some circles is kind of controversial. It's creative nonfiction, right? Which people start to think like, oh, I don't know, because then is it not true? But I embrace the term creative nonfiction because I think it allows for that sort of subjective space between the narrator and what's happening.
Yeah, you're definitely in the book, but as you said before, this book is not about you, you know. So it is interesting to think about how, you know, the I is important just to let us know that there is some one person telling us this story.
Yeah, and it's coming from a particular perspective. Like, you know, at one point in the book, I wanted to make clear that I was coming at this as someone who, as I said sort of at the beginning of our conversation, had not yet experienced catastrophic loss. So, I mean, I think it's important to tell readers that. And you know, I wasn't coming at this as any kind of expert at all. And, you know, as I've talked to people who have gone through loss, and everybody says that, you know, you can't really prepare for it. They tell me when I say like, oh, I thought I'd be able to prepare for it by writing this book. And they're all just like, ha, like, you can't prepare for that. Like, it's going to turn you on your head.
Yeah. So what was the biggest obstacle in writing the book and then getting it published?
With writing the book, I think I would say figuring out what linked all of these stories together, and sort of figuring out some of, like, I figured out, like, a major theme was what I think now is this nation's, I think we're kind of, you know, sort of poses this question in the book, you know, are we a little bit alienated from death and dying these days? And it's so funny because since writing the book, I've moved further in that direction of thinking like, yeah, we're super alienated. But the book poses that question that sort of reappears again and again. You know, I had been used to writing articles and doing radio stories. And so writing a book-length work and making it all work together as a whole was a big challenge. One of my favorite writers is John Ronson, a British writer who writes, he does nonfiction, journalistic nonfiction about, he wrote a book called The Psychopath Test. And that one was all about psychopaths and what makes a psychopath. And it has stories of all of these different people, but it's absolutely one narrative. Like he'll be working, we'll be on chapter four and he'll refer to like, oh, and I got a phone call from so-and-so, like the person he talked to first in chapter one, and it's all of a piece. And I would love to talk with him about, I mean, that is an amazing challenge. So I admire that, and I'd like to move more in that direction of being able to write single cohesive narratives. So that was definitely a big challenge. I think my second big challenge, like so many of us, is I spent, you know, I wanted to say a long time, but it probably wasn't. It was like it was like a little bit more than a year trying to find an agent and not being successful. When I had this manuscript, and a lot of folks said, you know, I love your writing. This subject is never going to sell because it's death. And so get back to me with your next project. Let me know what your next project is. And that happened again and again and again. And I know a lot of people spend a lot more time trying to find agents, so I probably can't complain. But then I lucked out and I found University of Georgia Press. And I remember it was just this, I remember having a conversation with my acquisitions editor and realizing that she believed in, you know, sort of the vision of this book as it stood in my brain and that she got it. And I just remember like feeling like that, like the Hallelujah chorus was playing. Cause I was like, oh my goodness, like I'm not crazy. Like she gets it and she's into it. And like, I wanted to like laugh and cry and like hug her through the phone magically. So that was really so gratifying after working on this for so long.
How do you think your understanding of mourning and death has changed since way back when you were just starting to begin this kind of investigation of mourning?
My view of death and mourning in this country has changed in a big way. When I first started working on the book, like our attitude toward death and mourning was like water around me. Like I didn't see it. It was transparent. And you know, there's this phrase that we've all heard, making the strange familiar and the familiar strange. And I think that's like, that is an endeavor that really interests me in writing, sort of looking at things that seemed weird to us and then kind of really becoming familiar with the context in which they're happening until they don't seem strange at all. And then looking at the context in which we live every day and sort of poking at it and poking at it until you realize like, oh, that's really weird. And so I'll give you like a really, like just an example of what I'm talking about. One topic that I was really psyched to investigate in doing this book was memorial photography. I'd seen the book Wisconsin Death Trip, which has lots of memorial photography in it. And, you know, I'd seen all these photos from the late 1800s, early 1900s of people with their dead relatives. They'd had these photos taken. It was fascinating to me, but I didn't for the life of me understand why anybody would do that, why anybody would want pictures of their dead. It didn't make any sense to me. And I thought it was weird. And so I was kind of excited to delve into it as like, oh, look at this weird thing. Which anytime you do that, like that's kind of a red flag. Like you're probably going to get your mind blown if you have, I don't know, half of an open mind. I met Juana Hogreef, who is a memorial photographer in the here and now. She takes memorial photos, calls them remembrance photos. She volunteers for an organization called Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. And These are photos of infants, very, very, very young infants, often like newborn, or they've been, you know, alive for like a few months or a few days. And they've been often living on this, like, you know, machinery, and their parents have never been able to hold them and things like that. And she takes photographs of the infants with their parents. And when I first talked to her, I didn't understand why you would want such a photo. But, you know, I went on talking with her and meeting with her and getting her story. And I came to realize that these photos that parents would have, that have of their infants as they die or as they have just died, are often the only photos that they have of their babies. And this also, in a world which might tend to want to downplay such a loss of an infant, because, you know, oh, that can't be as big a deal as if it were, like, you know, if it were a teenager or a grown child. You know, it's sad, but it's, you know, you might want to sort of think, oh, it's not on the same level of tragedy. But these photos really underscore that relationship and sort of say, yeah, this relationship existed and it mattered and it was real and it was a loss. And often the experience that the parents have of holding these children, it might be their first time doing that because the children were hooked up to machinery with wires all over them for their entire existence. So, you know, that moment is also a huge deal to them. So these might not be photos that parents, like, necessarily, you know, put out in the front room or on the mantle, but they have them and they matter to them because, again, it's evidence that this was a real relationship. And then similarly with memorial photography back in the 1800s, these might be the only photos that people would have of their loved ones. You know, this was the advent of photography. It was just starting. And so you'd have these photographers traveling around from town to town. And in this era, in the 1800s, this ideal, there was an ideal of the good death that somebody died at home, surrounded by family, and then originally because it came from evangelical Christianity, this idea that the person was saved before he or she died, that was really important in American culture. And whether or not you were a Christian, you were likely affected by this ideal of the good death, that you know, it was important to you that your loved one died at home and surrounded by family and sort of had a good death. And so the photograph was proof, whether or not it was actually true, you could pose people to look like they'd had a good death. And you know how photographs are and how they kind of shape our memories of how something happened. And then I started thinking about, you know, the good death was such a big deal in the 1800s. Today, most people die in hospitals. They die alone. Their deaths, and after they die, that's all taken care of by strangers. You know, maybe like a funeral director and a hospital staff. So it really made me begin to question, okay, well, what is our deal with death today that having images, proof that somebody died, makes us so very uncomfortable? And I include myself in that. It makes me uncomfortable. It still makes me, you know, kind of uncomfortable to think about. And that just kind of opened the door for me to, you know, really question our relationship with death in this country today.
Has the project and the investigation of writing this book made you any less terrified of loss?
I so want to say yes. I wish I could, but it wouldn't be true. I am still scared. Yeah, I've met so many people who work with shepherding people through loss. You know, I profile in this book a funeral director and a woman who's a chaplain who prefers doing funerals to anything else. She like loves doing funerals, and you know, obituary writers, and a woman who does memorial tattoos, and Juana Hogreef, the memorial photographer. And every single one of these people in his or her own way sort of had this understanding and this sort of peace with death that I don't have. And I don't know where that comes from. Maybe I think you need to, it's a life experience thing, something that I haven't experienced, and I'm not, you know, chomping at the bit to do so either. So it's something I'm still working on. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to the idea that you can be, think you're as prepared as you could ever be, but you'll never be prepared for any of those things. It's like you'll never be prepared to become a parent. You'll never be prepared to lose someone you love, even if you know everything about kind of death and mourning and the funeral business. Until it happens, you know, you can't actually prepare for it.
Absolutely. I mean, you can read all those What to Expect books, but but you know, you hear so many stories. I remember when my sister got my niece home for the first time from the hospital, her sort of calling me and saying, "Now what do we do? I don't know what to do. She's sleeping. What am I supposed to do something?"
Kate, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for having me. It was a real honor.
Sound Booth Podcast. Music by Mark Catalano. Check us out online at MissouriReview.com. There you can subscribe to the magazine, follow our Poem of the Week feature, and enter our 2014 Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize with $5,000 cash prizes in poetry, fiction, and essay. Thanks for listening, and check back next week for a new episode of the Missouri Review Sound Booth Podcast.